Right now, we welcome our friend Stephen Brunt. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
I'm seeing word this morning that, and I think this is quite funny, that Russian athletes, if they can prove they're not full of dope, can compete in the Olympics under the Russian flag. Like, should that not be, like, oh, really? Well, that's brilliant. That's a huge update, that if I'm not full of steroids, I can go to the Olympics.
Now, I may be wrong about this, but I also believe that it's impossible to prove a negative. You can't prove that you didn't do something.
Right.
So, I'm not sure that that's actually possible, that you can prove. You can test clean at some point, and you can pass a doping test, but if they're actually asking them to prove that they're clean, beyond that, it's pretty hard to do. I think it's a logical impossibility. So, but I do think that they're going to try. We have the IOC meeting today, and they're going to reaffirm the decision that to throw the Russian track team out of Rio. But I think both sides are going to be kind of looking for a bit of a face saver here and a compromise, because otherwise you're going to have the whole Russian team walk out of the Olympics, and then you're going to have the IOC with a big problem to deal with. We, one of the world powers, taking a powder and walking out on the show in Rio, and that kind of reminds you of 1980 or 1984 or 1988, which were not good times for the IOC. You know, the business of the IOC tends to suffer if you don't have everybody involved. So, I assume there's going to be some kind of a way that they allow somebody to march in under the Russian flag. But I think we'll know a whole lot more by the end of the day.
What's the state of the Olympic Games just in general? You have a Winter Games in Vancouver. It's great. But there's so much lately of athletes that are doping, of countries that either can't afford it or do it anyway, and then it hemorrhages money, and countries that there's health risks and everything else. Where are we at? It just seems like to pull one off that's a success is like single-digit percentage.
Yeah. No, I think we're at kind of where we've kind of reached the day of reckoning for them, because, you know, look at what happened with the Winter Games. The next one's going to be in South Korea, but no one really wanted the one after that. The Norwegians, who everybody thought were going to take it, and after having the great success with Lillehammer in 94, turned it down. They had a referendum, and people said, we don't want this. So those Winter Games are going to end up in Beijing, because it was either there or Kazakhstan. And so you've got countries that are just saying, we don't want to build those facilities. We don't want to do what you require of us. The Summer Games are obviously coming up in Rio, and there are always alarm bells at this point before an Olympics, and everybody's always saying this. You know, everything's going to hell in a handbasket, but it kind of looks like things are really going to hell in a handbasket down there. The state government in Rio, that area, has said essentially we don't have any money, and we have huge infrastructure problems. You've got the president has been impeached in Brazil. Virtually every other significant politician has been indicted. And, of course, they staged a World Cup 2 years ago. So it's insane what they've done. So you're going to wreck a country and wreck its economy in order to stage a 17-day party. So that's a big one. You know, and the other part of it is going to be what the value of TV rights are, because you think of how does the Olympic business work? There's kind of three pillars. You know, one is that countries underwrite it, usually with, invariably with public money, that they build the facilities and build the stage for this thing. The other is, number two, is TV rights and what that content is worth, which has gone up, 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 right? And then the three would be corporate sponsorship and, companies willing to put in huge amounts of money to have a kind of affiliation, association with the five rings. But if any of those three pillars start to deteriorate, you're kind of in trouble. The logical thing to do would be to pull in their horns a little bit, start going back to cities that have staged the games in the past where facilities already exist, downscale things a little bit. But, that has never been, they've always had kind of new suckers willing to pay the bill. And it's kind of, you kind of get the sense that they're running out of that, especially, at least in democracies, at least where people have a vote. Do you really want to be dealing exclusively with countries where the people who underwrite the games don't have any voice in it? You know, because that's kind of where we're headed here. The next summer games are in Tokyo, so that would be an exception to what I'm saying. But boy, beyond that, it is something's got to change there in Lausanne.
Yeah, and you mentioned it, like the disintegration of the interest of public money to build billions of dollars of facilities. Like the price tag for Sochi is exceptionally high.
You're
going back to a dictatorship for the second time this millennium in China. I mean, I know when I close my eyes and think of winter, it's Beijing for sure.
Yeah, no, like it's cold there, but there aren't any mountains anywhere close. And it's just they've run out of patsies. And unless you can turn this into something that makes sense, where there's some kind of a sustainable element to it, and I know they always talk about that, or you can reuse the facilities and et cetera, et cetera. Well, there's only so many ways you can use a ski jump. Never mind what you have to do in summer, where it's way, way bigger. They haven't had to make tough decisions because there's always been somebody next in line and somebody who was willing to outbid the other guy. Because during those 17 days, it casts glory on the country that hosts the games. It's great for the politicians who are in power when the games are on. You get to wave your flag, and everybody feels happy. And everybody, I guarantee you, when Rio's on, whatever's going on, even if people, in the triathlon are swimming in essentially an open sewer, we watching on TV are going to be happy because there'll be some Canadians win some medals, and there'll be a lot of fresh-faced athletes, and it'll work. It's the most perfect formula ever. Mm-hmm. It always, always works.
Well, and the timing of this conversation is interesting because just yesterday, Calgary City Councillors voted in favor of spending $5 million on exploring a bid for the Winter Games of 2026 in our city. So this would be a return where there is some infrastructure, and the discussion will be, is this good news or is this bad news? Do we want it or do we not?
Well, as long as you do it with kind of eyes wide open, I don't think there's a problem. And if you say, okay, you do have facilities you do have a bobsled track which you can use. The ski jump's a little bit problematic, but I assume there's a way to use the ski jump. You're within spitting distance of alpine terrain that you can use for a downhill and use for the alpine races. You certainly have got places you could do cross country skiing. So there are a lot of ways in which it makes sense and where you get some more use out of the 88 facilities. I also assume that they would use it as an excuse to get a new hockey rink built. Which is usually the cover for these kind of things, where you say, "Okay, this will help us justify putting public money into a new rink." But again, as long as you do that with eyes wide open, in Vancouver, they spent a ton of money on the Sea to Sky Highway, they spent a ton of money on the SkyTrain from the airport to downtown, and they did that kind of under the cover of the Olympics. But both of those things are good.
Yeah.
They're good. They're good for people who live there. They're good for business, and maybe that's the only way you get them built. But just don't. As long as people don't go in kind of pretending that it's going to make back the money you spend. I know Calgary 88 did, but that was that was like a perfect storm, right? The TV rights money went crazy that time, and way, way beyond what anyone thought it would be. That's not going to happen again.
All right, I think we can move on.
Is that all right? Yeah, it's kind of depressing that one.
It is a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Speaking of depressing, what's happened to... what's happened to the Stroh show?
Oh, I thought you were talking about Strombolopoulos to start. I had to reset here.
No,
Steve, nothing to talk about there.
Shush!
Steven. Come on now.
Hush.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Motorcycle. No. Come on.
Marcus Stroman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would choose to look at this as kind of the natural bump that a young pitcher is going to face in the major leagues when major league hitters start to figure him out a bit. And I think that's a big part of what's happened here. Marcus Stroman has, as we all know, has ridiculously high level of confidence in himself. He's a very, very confident guy. He has a huge repertoire of pitches. He does things, he quick pitches. He does all kinds of stuff, can spin the ball really, really well. But big league hitters are really smart about facing big league pitchers. And eventually, if they kind of understand that, at a certain point, you're going to have, you box yourself into a corner as a pitcher. If you can't throw certain pitches in the zone with consistency, they will sit and they will wait. And what's happening right now is that the sinker he throws, which got him a ton of ground ball outs early in the season, he's been leaving it up in the zone. And if you throw that pitch up at the knees big league hitters are going to kill it. And they're just waiting. They're just sitting on it now because they know that some of his secondary pitches he can't throw for strikes. And they're waiting and waiting and waiting. And I think his confidence has been rocked. And every pitcher hits this moment. You know, maybe not quite as dramatically as the Roy Halladay one, but that's the one a lot of people remember. You know, he came up almost through a no-hitter and then completely fell apart. And they sent him down to Double-A and remade his delivery, you know, from scratch, rebuilt him. And then he came back up and became Roy Halladay. I don't think that's going to happen with Stroman. And he's a, you know, he's not a kid because he went to college, and he's, you know, kind of a young veteran in some ways. But I think this is one of those moments where he's got a lot of talent, and I don't think that's an issue. But you also have to kind of start fighting your own tendencies. You have to kind of listen to other people, listen to your pitching coach, in a lot of cases listen to your catcher, and say, you know, this pitch that I've been getting guys out with my whole life isn't working right now. I've got to change up my pattern, and I've got to, and I, you know, there's some technical stuff that people talk about, and again, I don't pretend to understand the difference because, you know, I'm throwing a lot of pitches, but you know, getting on top of the ball rather than on to the side of the ball, and there will be people who will come back and say, you know, he's going to have mechanical issues because he's a short guy and he doesn't throw with the downward plane, and we've been saying this forever, but I got a lot of faith in Stroman. I got a lot of faith in him in a lot of ways, and I think it's not going to hurt that he gets out of the AL East for a little while. If you look at the teams he's going to pitch against in the next 2 or 3 weeks, it's, you know, it's maybe a little bit easier than pitching to the Orioles and pitching to the Red Sox.
So do you cut back his repertoire because he does have 5 pitches, or is this strictly a mechanical adjustment, or is it a bit of both?
I would say both. You know, I would say both. I would want to have a talk with him about shortening up the repertoire a little bit. And, you know, I think they are working on him on the mechanical stuff to try and get that ball to dive more and get it down so that they're beating the ball into the turf and into the dirt rather than hitting line drives. The spooky number with him, you know, they measure the speed of balls off the bat now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's had a lot of hard contact. You know, this isn't fluky balls dropping in. They've been ripping balls off him. Some of the highest numbers in baseball have been of the pitches leaving the bats of guys that Marcus Stroman's pitching to. So he's not fooling guys. He's not fooling anybody right now. But, you know, this is the point where, you know, they always talk about that, right? Learning how to pitch, you know, learning how to pitch to major league hitters, learning how to pitch to guys who, once they've seen you 4 or 5 times, they go, okay, I get what this guy's doing. And but again, I have a lot of faith in him. I think he's a, you know, he's a mature guy. You know, baseball wise, he's a very mature guy. But that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. You know, the Jays are fortunate right now that they've got really 4 other guys, if you count Dickey being consistently R.A. Dickey, but they've got 4 other guys in the rotation who are going really well right now. And it's not a total crisis to have Marcus Stroman hit a bump in the road.
Everyone forgets, we go back a month and change. May 17th was his 16th consecutive start without a loss, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's been on a great roll. And he's still, it's early days for him career-wise. But I know it's been kind of whipped into a crisis here in a way. And, you know, talk about whether he should be sent down or not, send him to Buffalo to straighten him out. I think they've got the 2 off days this week, which is going to take a little bit of the heat off the rotation. They've got Arizona tonight and tomorrow night, which is not, again, not exactly murderer's row in terms of hitting. I kind of feel like these things, you know, all baseball questions tend to be answered over 162, not over 5 or 10. And take the long view, take a deep breath. Jays are, both the Red Sox and the Orioles lost last night. Jays are in a wild card position or close to it. It's going to be fun.
I wanted to play you something. This was, and you may have heard it already from Primetime Sports with your old friend.
Yeah.
John Morosi was a guest yesterday talking about Jose Bautista and, you know, whether or not his asking price or what he's going to get is maybe coming down, but he mentioned another name, that being Michael Saunders.
It would not surprise me if in total dollars, Saunders gets more total dollars than Bautista. Hard as that sounds to say, it would not shock me just based on age, because we saw it, guys. We saw it last wintertime with Jason Hayward.
Now, is he talking out of his wazoo, or is there something there? Because, again, this is the guy they tried to deal twice.
Yeah, and the They tried to, the guy they were going to deal for, they would have had one more year of control with Jay Bruce, and he's actually having a really good season, too.
Yeah, he is.
But you know what? I'd like to get to the end of a full season of Michael Saunders playing like this first before we have that, because that's when people are going to decide about what he's worth. And it's, he has been great and unexpectedly great offensively. And I don't think he's a great outfielder. I hate to say it, watching him play, and he makes a lot of boneheaded plays on the base paths. So I kind of wonder about his baseball IQ sometimes. But he's having a great he's having a great year at the plate. But it's a bit of a red herring throwing him, because he and Bautista are completely different guys. Saunders is at a different stage in his career. He's going to play the outfield, again, a bit erratically, but he's going to play the outfield wherever he goes. Jose Bautista is, at this point, an injured guy who's closing in on 40, who is not going to be a corner outfielder, I don't think, any beyond this year for anybody. He's going to be a DH or a first baseman, who looks, he's still a great hitter. He gets on base a ton. But the best of Jose Bautista we have seen. We are past, he's going down the far side of the mountain now. And there's going to be a very different kind of risk-reward equation in terms of what you're going to give him and how many years you're going to give him. And I think I told you guys this, but in the spring, spring training, when Jose was talking about 5 years, or at least that story broke, I was talking to a major league president, general manager, off the record, and asked him what he thought Bautista would get, and he said 3 years. Maybe three plus an option. Maybe two plus an option. And that was, that was with a fresh start this season and assuming that Bautista was going to go out and hit 35 or 40 home runs and have a Bautista year. So I always thought the five-year thing was a pipe dream. And, so that maybe that does mean that Michael Saunders and Jose Bautista money is pretty similar. But it's like, what are you going to pay for an apple? What are you going to pay for an orange? They're really different players at different stages of their baseball lives right now.
Yeah, of course. One guy's 6 years younger. You can confidently sign Saunders for 6 years. I don't think anyone wants to go, as you said, over three with Jose. So
no, and
value is not going to be close.
It's interesting that the discussion here, because obviously there was at first this spring there was you've got to sign Jose, and then the 5 year thing came out and everybody went, whoa, that doesn't make a lot of sense baseball wise to pay a guy into his 40s. And the conversation has shifted here really to what about Edwin? He's younger. He's a DH. You know what he is. He's going to be streaky, as we have seen. But, boy, when he gets hot, he can still hit. 3 years of Edwin for a team that's got probably a 2 or 3 year competitive window that it's looking at with the current group kind of might make sense. Three times 25 for Edwin Encarnacion. Does that make more sense than paying Jose Bautista? Because Jose Bautista is going to be your DH if you bring him back. So I know Edwin said he wouldn't. People said they wouldn't negotiate during the season. But if I was Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins right now, if not him, you've got to find somebody else to do that job. And Edwin likes it in Toronto. He's a very easy guy to get along with in the clubhouse, kind of a not a disruptive presence in any way. I think that they were a little wary about him in terms of his fitness level, but the guy just hits. So it would not shock me if, Edwin's the guy that comes back and Jose's the guy that doesn't come back.
Everyone forgets he didn't have a spring either. I mean, this is what he normally does in May, and he is about a month behind in terms of not having much spring.
Yep. And again, if you look at the free agent market this year, so if you let him go, it's up to him. If he walks, you're going to have to replace those runs. You're going to have to replace that in the lineup, and there's not really a whole lot on the free agent market, so now you're talking about trading. And again, the Jays are in a spot where they've really got nobody coming along from the minors in the next year or two. But they have the rotation pretty much intact going into next year. They've got Josh Donaldson. They've got Russell Martin. They've got Troy Tulowitzki. You're almost compelled to try and win, for the next couple of years. So you're going to have to backfill that position somehow, and why not fill it with the guy who's already there?
Last one real quick. Saunders has talked so much about, playing for his boyhood favorite team in Toronto, how painful last year was watching on the sidelines. You could talk all you want about Jose or Edwin, but this guy's 29. He's been their best player this year, as crazy as that sounds, when a sprinkler head ended his year last year. Do you think that that's a guy that you could talk to and would have the appetite to hang around long-term?
Maybe. I always think guys say whatever they say, but they mostly want to get paid as much as they can get paid. So I just don't know. Again, if you're the Blue Jays, you have to make a really he looks better than the guy they thought they were getting. You know, he looks better than the guy that Alex Anthopoulos traded for. So is that a blip, or is that a guy just coming into his own and having a year when he's, you know, been healthy to this point? That's a tough call. You know, it's a tough call on him. I'm not sure what he is, except that he's been. But we have seen players. There's a lot of examples. You know, sometimes, and again, his pedigree is different than, say, Chris Colabello's. But, you know, a year ago we were all marveling at Chris Colabello, and you know, a guy who kind of came out of nowhere and had a grand. I know there were other circumstances there, but I always think with baseball players, they always kind of regress to the mean. You know, that over time they generally tend to be what you thought they were. Jose Bautista would be an exception. There are exceptions. But is Michael Saunders an elite corner outfielder, major league corner outfielder? Because he's going to get paid like one if he goes to market. But if you're an organization, if you're the Jays, you have to decide if that's what he really is. And I'm not sure.
Thank you for your time, as always, Stephen. We're all smarter because of it.
My pleasure.
Have a great week. We'll catch up Friday.
See you, boys.